So although the title has changed and I've kind of reorganized the material a bit, I will be talking about typical and atypical numerical development, but in a, I think, a slightly different way from the way I'd originally conceived it. Also, I gave a talk with the title I originally gave to Pierre a couple of times in the last few months, and I thought I ought to do something different. So because I'm here talking at the Archive, I thought I would just focus a little bit on a couple of the themes that that Piaget pioneered in this area. So these are the two themes I want to look at. One is the role of counting in the emergence of numerical abilities, and the second is domain general cognitive capacities, assimilation, accommodation, equilibration, and so on, which are meant to apply across all different domains of knowledge. And I want to ask whether this is sufficient to explain the development of the concept of number. So let's start with the role of counting. And as you all know, Piaget didn't think that there was any connection between the ability to count, which is of course acquired by coming into contact with the cultural tool of counting, because he found in his own research, as you all know, that he found kids who were quite good at counting but didn't seem to understand some of the more fundamental aspects of number, and also he found kids who understood some of the could conserve but that were not very good at counting. And the reason why I raise this today is because there's another position which is exactly opposite to Piaget's, which I'm calling the Whorfian view of Carey, Susan Carey's developmental psychologist at Harvard. And it's really originated with the work of Stanislas Dehaene, who I see is coming later this month. So you'll get both sides of this argument. Carey argued that number words are necessary. And she, like Dehaene, has claimed there are two domains of core knowledge, as she calls them, they call them, that have what she calls numerical content. One of them is parallel individuation. This is the object file system of Anne Treisman and others. And the point about this system is that it enables you to keep track of objects that you want to attend to in the environment, and it has an upper limit of 3 or 4 items. Carey's argument is that because it has an upper limit of 3 or 4 items, you know precisely how many items there are that you're attending to. Now, I've argued elsewhere that this particular claim makes no sense, and if we want to discuss it later, I'm happy to do that. But the other system, we have, I've no argument with this, is that we have a way of representing quantity in terms of analog magnitudes. And this was a theory originally put forward by Dehaene and Changeux back 20 years ago now. And so this is the way in which you extract numerical information, or approximate numerical information, from the environment. You see some things in the environment. You construct a representation in terms of the objects in space. You normalize these objects, so although these objects are different in real life, in your representation they have, if you like, the same value or the same weight. You sum them, and then you map that sum onto a mental number line. So you end up for the first 5 numbers with internal representations that look like that. Now, one of the things that you can see here is that the representations for each of the numbers overlaps with all the other numbers. So it's not a very good representation of our everyday concepts of natural numbers, where you know that 2 is actually different from 3, it doesn't overlap with 3. But this is a very interesting and actually revolutionary account of the way in which you can extract some kind of quantity representation which is normalized from the environment. Now, Carey saw that this created a problem, that the analog magnitude representations obscure one of the foundational relations among successive integers. We will come back to the use of her word integers later, because it's wrong. That each one is exactly one more than the one before. Of course, you all know that. So the countless representation of number, that is, the sequence of number words, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, transcends the representational power of both the representational systems with numerical content that are available to the pre-verbal infants. For these precursors lack the capacity to represent integers. Mechanisms for getting from two domains of core knowledge to concepts of integers done by a process she calls bootstrapping, which is inductive inference from mapping number terms to numerosities of greater from representations that are 3 or less to larger representations. And if you've got a number term that you can say, like 7, but which you haven't mapped onto an exact number, then this term for the infant or the child just means a lot. Now, the problem with bootstrapping, as Galistel has pointed out in a very interesting review of this book by Carey, this is an example of bootstrapping. So the idea is you pull yourself up by your bootstraps, is that it's impossible. You can't pull yourself up by your bootstraps. That's why it's used metaphorically, at least in English. So here you can see somebody trying to stop himself falling over the cliff by hanging onto his bootstraps or his bootlegs. So that's the problem, that the mechanism by which you can bootstrap from these two fundamental representations doesn't seem to work. And the arguments as to why you need to have some kind of bootstrapping mechanism comes from the fact that from anthropological arguments which show that cultures where you don't have counting words or counting words are not used in the way that we use them are not able to do even very simple exact number arithmetic. And I just want to go through a couple of these examples and then get on to some work of our own. So if Carey's and others who take this view are right, then cultures lacking counting words would not be able to represent the integers, that is, exact numbers, whereas if Piaget is right, then the lack of counting words should not matter. Okay, so that's the argument that I want to address here. So the first example of this came from Peter Gordon, a paper in Science, where he looked at a tribe called the Pirahã, whose language does indeed lack counting words, though, as you can see from this picture of the Pirahã, this they were being taught number symbols. Either they weren't interested or were unable to learn it. This is Pirahã drawing. And he had a number of non-verbal tasks that he gave to a bunch of Pirahã adults, of which essentially 4 adults were reported. And along the bottom of these graphs you can see the target that's required, and up here is the proportion correct. So where you've got, these are actually batteries. So where you've got 5 batteries, the Pirahã adult has to match it with simple one-to-one correspondence, actually, the same number of batteries. And they're quite good up to three, they're perfect up to three, and then performance goes off. If you have to match to a number of pebbles, match a number of batteries to a number of pebbles, you're good up to two, and then performance falls off. If you put the target and the response orthogonally, you're even worse. If you've got an uneven line, you get very strange performance. If you have to copy it, very bad, except for one. If you give brief presentation, you're really bad. Nuts in a can task, where you see nuts going into a can, then you have to take the experimenter puts nuts into a can, and then the subject has to take the nuts out. And so if he doesn't take out the same, they're all men, by the way, if he doesn't take out the right number of nuts, leaves one in, or tries to go for one that isn't there, then they're not doing well. But even on one nut, as you can see here, they're not perfect, which seems to be very strange. And then there's a candy in the box task, which we won't talk about. So Gordon concludes from this, the present experiments allow us to ask whether humans who are not exposed to a number system can represent exact quantities for medium-sized sets of four or five. The answer appears to be negative. The Piraha inherit just the abilities to exactly enumerate small sets of less than three items, if processing factors are not unduly taxing. Now these were, as I say, a very small sample of Piraha. The experiments weren't very well conducted. The linguist at the Piraha site said that the subjects didn't actually understand what was being asked of them, which is why they were performing so badly. A much better experiment was done by Dehan's group with the Mundaruku. Mundaruku, different part of the Amazon basin. And this is the experimenter, Pierre Pica, who's really a linguist, showing the stimuli, which aren't physical objects, but presentations on an Apple Macintosh machine. Now you might think, of course, that people in the Amazon jungle are more familiar with PCs than with Macintoshes, and this is why performance wasn't so good. But I don't think this is the right answer. Okay. But anyway, these were not done with concrete objects. He asked subjects to name particular numerosities, and they're pretty good at naming one, pretty good at naming two, fairly good at three, but there's quite a lot of dispersion, and they get much worse thereafter. So he gave them these comparison tasks where you only need an approximate or analog sense of numerosity. So you have to look at these two numerosities here and say whether there were more red or more blue. These are the percent correct. These are French controls. And the Mundaruku are pretty good, but they're not as good as the French on this task. But they're pretty good, okay? On approximate addition and comparison, where you see two sets of dots go into a can, this is all on the computer, and then you have to say whether this represents the addition. They're about as good as the French controls on this. Now you can see there are six panels here, and these are monolingual Mundaruku speakers who've had no instruction. These are bilingual, they're bilingual in Mundaruku and Portuguese, but have had no instruction, and these are bilingual who have had instruction. And as you can see, even if you've got Portuguese, which should give you a big advantage, as you'll see in this exact task, they're not very good. So all of them do really bad compared to French control. So here the task is, you see these blobs go into a box, then you see some come out, and you have to say which of these represents the number still left in the can. So the French are really quite good at this, but all of the Mundurucú are bad at it, even those who have Portuguese and have been to school. Anyway, this is what they conclude. They say, is calculation possible without language, or is the human ability for arithmetic dependent on the language faculty? To clarify the relationship between language and arithmetic, we studied the numerical cognition in speakers, Mundurucú and Amazonian language, with a very small lexicon of number words. Although the Mundurucú lack words for numbers beyond five, they're able to compare and add large approximate numbers way beyond their naming range. However, they fail in exact arithmetic with numbers larger than four or five. Our results imply a distinction between a universal system of number approximation and a language-based counting system for exact number and arithmetic. Okay. Now, Gordon, Pica et al. Were not the first to notice the possible implications of cultures without counting words. They were not the first. The first actually was an English philosopher called John Locke, who in 1690 reported in an essay concerning human understanding, a very famous book in English philosophy, what we shall call the American problem. And this is what he said. He said, some Americans I have spoken with, so he has direct knowledge of them, who were otherwise of quick and rational parts enough, that is, they didn't lack for intelligence, could not, as we do, by any means count to 100, nor had any distinct idea of that number. He was talking not about Americans from the 51 states, or however many it were then, 13 states, but a tribe from the depths of the Brazilian jungle who had no names for numbers above five. So what was their ability to represent numbers greater than five, given they only had numbers up to five? But the Americans can reckon beyond five by showing their fingers and the fingers of others who are present. So if you ask them to show 20, somebody would hold up 10, and I would ask somebody else to hold up another 10. And then we would say, well, there you are. That's what you asked for. Okay. We did some research with Australian Aborigines. We've published a few papers on this, and we'll doubtless publish more, from two sites in Australia, in the Northern Territory, a place called Willowra, which is about 300 kilometres northwest of Alice Springs, where they speak a language called Wolbury, and a settlement on an island off the north coast of Arnhem Land called Anwurugu, where they speak a language called Anindilyakwa. Now, Anindilyakwa is interesting for two reasons. One is it has very few number words, and children don't learn them because these number words are only used in a very limited number of ritual purposes to which children are not don't have access. But the other thing is that it's a language isolate, like Basque. There is no other language like it as far as we know. However, almost all Australian languages, and there used to be 400, they're probably 200 now, have no counting words, as far as we know. If you look at all the grammars and lexicons of Australian languages, and I've talked with Australian language experts, there aren't any languages that have counting words. So these guys really don't have counting words. In Wolbury, for example, they have a word for one, a word for two, a word for few, and a word for many. And that's it. They don't have a word for three. In Anguragu, they have words up to five, but those are only used for ritual purposes. Now, for those of you who don't know these places, I'll give you a picture. This is our researcher, Delith Lloyd. This is Central Desert Country. If you're going to participate in research here, you have to eat witchetty grub. They're cooked. I didn't eat them, but Delith did. And it's a great treat. They go off hunting for these witchetty grub. So it's not as easy as doing research in the laboratory, right? The other place we Angourougou is on an island called Groot Island, which looks a bit like this. This is a lady fishing, because very good fishing around there. It also has a lot of crocodiles, salties, big crocodiles. So I just want you to know that the data I'm going to present was collected under very dangerous circumstances. And I'll show you some of the tasks that we used. We did a lot of tasks because, you know, these are very, very valuable populations. They're disappearing fast, and so we do as much as we can. So this is the basic setup. This is my researcher, Fiona Reynolds. This is the interpreter who speaks Anangourougou in English, and this is the subject in the middle, who, as far as possible, was monolingual in Anangourougou. And so Fiona has a mat, the subject has a mat, and we're using counters. So the first task I'm going to show you is memory for counters. That what the subject has to do here is to put on her mat the same number of counters as on Fiona's mat. Now, of course, because they don't have a word for number, let alone for numbers, you have to explain it in a different way. Then Fiona covers up her tray, and the subject puts out as many as she thinks are on that tray.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Do they have a word for same?
Yeah, they have a word for same, but not the same number. Okay. Well, then we did cross-modal matching. Okay, just to show that it doesn't just apply to recognizing visual patterns. So Fiona would take two sticks, and this is a more high-tech experiment than the one you saw before, and she'd bang it a certain number of times, and the subject had to put out a counter for each bang, okay? And so there she is putting out this. Okay. So let's have a look at the results just from these two experiments. There are many more, I'm happy to talk about them. The way we've represented this, this is the target set size, this is the children's responses. These are children, by the way, between 4 and 7. The green ones are English, the red ones are Walbury, and the blue ones are Anangourougou. And as you can see, statistically, there's no difference between the groups. If anything, the Walbury speakers are doing slightly better than the others because these are bigger blocks. But there are actually more, I think we had more subjects there. And this is cross-modal matching. Again, you can see that the kids from the Northern Territory were doing as well as the kids who spoke English. These are from Melbourne. And so as far as we can see, there's no advantage in being able to count using number words. We also looked at strategies, and one of the things we looked at was how kids did it, because we're very interested in strategy, and if I have time I'll talk about strategy change in mainstream Australian kids. But these are the proportion of correct answers that use a pattern matching strategy in memory for counters. So Fiona would put out, let's say, 4 counters. They would either be in a random arrangement or in a canonical arrangement, 1, 2, 3, 4. And the Melbourne kids generally didn't copy the arrangement when they were reconstructing what she'd done, whereas the kids in the Northern Territory did use the pattern, the spatial arrangement that Fiona used. So they were doing the task very well, but using a quite different strategy from the kids in Melbourne who spoke English. And for non-verbal addition, I didn't show you the non-verbal addition. The non-verbal addition task is same setup. You put, say, 4 counters on your mat, or Fiona put 4 counters on her mat, covered them up, and then would add under the cover a certain number of additional counters, and then the child would have to reconstruct what was now under the mat. And again, the kids there were just as good as the kids in Melbourne. Here they're using, but very few of them use pattern matching, but they use sort of sequential enumeration, whereas in the Northern Territory, kids in the Northern Territory tended to use pattern matching more. So they found a strategy to do the task. Okay. So the kids who didn't have counting words seemed to do as well as the kids in Melbourne who did have counting words. So in that sense, Piaget is correct that you can have a conception of cardinal numbers, that is, set size, without actually having counting words. However, of course, learning to count is important because they provide a handy notation. And here's a couple of quotes from philosophers, actually Whitehead and Russell. So Whitehead wrote, by relieving the brain of all unnecessary work, a good notation sets it free to concentrate on more advanced problems and in effect increases the mental power of the race. So if you've actually got a handy notation, it's a good thing. Locke said the same thing, and I'll come on to that. Russell also distinguished between knowledge by acquaintance and knowledge by description. So we know that you know how many objects there are in a set for a fairly small number. Okay, so you can recognize the fiveness of a set, or indeed any set that you can count. But when you get to large numbers where you don't count, you can't recognize them, the numbers straight off, is that you actually know what these numbers mean through description by having a symbolism which allows you to represent them exactly. So I'm going to come back to that point. Now I'm going to argue here that where Piaget was wrong was that it's not enough just to have general reasoning capabilities to do even simple number tasks. You need specific numerical capacities. So we just need to just go over what numbers are. Okay. I suppose you all think you know what numbers are, don't you? Okay, so this is what Locke said. He said, the simplest idea is the idea of one. And this could be repeated, and by adding repetitions together, you get complex ideas of larger numbers. Thus, by adding one to one, we have a complex idea of a couple, etc. We should give each complex idea a name or sign whereby to know it from those before and after. This is one place where counting is useful. For without a name or mark to distinguish that precise collection, we will hardly be kept... We will hardly be kept from a bee. From being in a heap of confusion. I wasn't a heap of confusion here. So what he says, if you don't have a separate name, you don't know, mentally, you're going to be confused. So distinct names conduce to our well reckoning. By reckoning, he meant calculation. And also, the addability of numbers gives us the clearest and most distinct idea of infinity. Now, we can update what Locke said. And this was done originally by a philosopher called Peano. And you can formalize this in terms of an axiom system. So there's a single distinguished element, or first term, let's call it zero. There's a unary operation, S, called it the successor operation, such that every element X has a unique immediate successor element, S of X. Zero is not the successor of any element, and no two elements have the same successor. And every element other than zero can be reached from zero by finitely many applications of the successor operation. This set of axioms defines what are now called omega sequences, which will include the natural numbers, the ordinal numbers, and the cardinal numbers, which are set sizes. And these omega sequences are isomorphic with each other. That is, you can put the ordinal numbers in one-to-one correspondence with the natural numbers, and the cardinal numbers in one-to-one correspondence with the natural numbers, and so on. Now, notice that Carey's integers do not form an omega sequence, since they have no distinguished element. There is no first term in the sequence, because integers go, as you know, from minus omega to plus omega. So there are integers include minus elements. So there's no first term. Approximate numerosities or analog representations can't be omega sequences because there's no successor relation. Okay. So it's clear that this definition of omega sequences requires both seriation and transitivity, and for cardinal numbers, class inclusion. Therefore, Piaget is right that the cardinal number concepts entails understanding what he would call class, I would call set relations, and seriation, as we'll see in a moment. Piaget is broadly right about conservation. It requires understanding which transformations affect the numerosity, the size of a set. And I just want to make one point very clear, because it's something that got Russell into some difficulty and all, which is that we're talking about number as a property of a set. It's not the set itself. If you have it as the set itself, you get into something called the theory of types, which is really complicated, and it doesn't seem to follow naturally from what we understand of numbers. Otherwise, you get paradoxes. Okay. Now, it's easy to test for individual differences in the capacity to represent the numerosity of the set size. And now I'm getting on to what the original title was. Okay. So you can compare numerosities, where you get something called the distance effect. So the more different either two symbolic numbers are or two sets are, the easier it is to say which is bigger, unsurprisingly. And this is just data from our lab, but it's been done hundreds and hundreds of times. So this is reaction time up here. So if the difference between two numbers is 1, it takes you longer than if the difference is 8. But this is for single-digit numbers. Now, we use this fact in a brain scanning experiment, because what we wanted to know, whether numerosities are represented abstractly and differently from analog quantities in the brain. So this is the experiment, old experiment, but slightly complicated. So we had this was done in a scanner. So we had two types of discrete stimuli, blue and green rectangles. They could either be distributed in time in one condition, so you'd see blue, 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 green, 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 blue, 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 green, 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 or they could be distributed in space. Okay? And the task was always the same: is there more green or more blue? And there was a button press response. But we also had an analog version of that task. So you would see just one blue square that would change continuously into green, and then back into blue, then back into green, back into blue. The task was to say more green or more blue, and we would have something like that, so more green or more blue, where there weren't distinct objects in that array. As you can see, that is basically this display blurred. So what we did is we recorded brain activity for each of those four conditions. We subtracted the analog version from the discrete version, and then we took the conjunction of what was left. Now, if we were wrong, if there either isn't any difference between representing numerosities and representing quantities, then we wouldn't get a result, okay? Because you subtract one from the other, you get nothing. Or, if the way in which you represent objects distributed in space is different from the way in which you have objects distributed in time, and you did a conjunction, you would get nothing. So there was quite a strong hypothesis testing experiment, this. But actually, we did get something. So we got two areas in the occipital lobe when you did the subtraction and the conjunction. And that's not surprising, because the actual visual display is different, so you would expect something different in the visual area. But they didn't seem to be sensitive to number. However, if we look at areas in the intraparietal sulcus, they were sensitive to the difference in the number of blue and green rectangles. So where in the example I showed you here, there were 6 blue and 14 green, that's easy, but it could have been 11 blue and 9 green, and that's harder. And in this intraparietal sulcus area, bilaterally, what you found was that the more difficult the discrimination, the more activity you got in those two areas. So those were the areas that were actually processing numerosities, not just quantities, because we'd done the subtraction. So there's a distinct numerosity processing area in the brain. In fact, there were two bilaterally. Well, we can show those two areas, by the way, are part of a larger network for doing arithmetical calculations. Before this, we did quite a lot of work with patients. Actually, this is how I got into the whole area, showing that these parietal areas are actually necessary to do numerical tasks. So the first patient that we ever reported in this area was patient CG, who had quite a large lesion in the left parietal lobe. The rest of the brain was okay. Language was okay. Reasoning, which we tested on the Piagetian prerequisites along with other reasoning tasks, she was absolutely fine on. But number skills, she could count to 4, but she couldn't do anything with numbers above 4. So, for example, if you put 5 objects out on the table and you said, she was Italian, you say, Signora, can you count these? She'd go, uno, due, tre, quattro. She'd point to the 5th one and she'd say, la mia matematica finisce qui. My mathematics finishes here. And she could do nothing with numbers above 4. More recently, we saw a patient, IH, in London, who had relatively intact parietal lobe, but the rest of the brain was degenerating, had a degenerating dementing disease. He had really, really severe language problems. He was at chance on single word picture pointing. That is, if you said point to the orange, he would be at chance at doing that. His speech consisted largely of stereotyped phrases. We couldn't test his reasoning because he didn't understand what we were saying to him, but he lived independently. He could dress himself. He needed help to come to the hospital, but otherwise he seemed okay, at least at the beginning. But on single and multi-digit calculation, he was flawless. I mean, he was really, really good. He could still do it. So these areas seem to be necessary for doing number tasks. Okay. Now, another way of assessing individual differences in numerosity processing, I'm going to focus more on this now, is enumerating sets. So this is data that we collected, but lots of other people have collected the same sort of data. So you just have to say how many dots are on the display, and this is how long it takes you. So in the subitizing range, up to about 4 for adults, it's about 50 milliseconds per item, whereas in the estimating or counting range, it's about 250 milliseconds per item. And so it depends a bit on how people are doing it. If you insist that they get it right, they might count. If you don't insist, they'll estimate. And this is just the correct answer. Correct. Now, you can see this is quite a complex curve, and you can actually analyze it in terms of 4 parameters. You can look at the subitizing range, you can look at basic reaction time, how long it takes you to say one when there's just one object. You can look at the point of discontinuity, which technically just means when the best fitting curve becomes exponential, and then you can have a look at the counting range. So look at those four parameters, right? They're important. It's important to think about that. So let's look at the individual differences in numerosity processing in the development of arithmetic. So this is a longitudinal study, still going on. We're still writing up different parts of it. So 159 children have survived being tested from 5.5 to 11. They've been tested 7 times, over 20 cognitive tests per time. We used item time calculation, dot enumeration, which is what I'm going to focus on, number comparison, both adjusted for simple reaction time, and Raven's color progressive matrices, which is a test of intelligence. So we didn't use, we wanted to know how good the kids were. Of course, they change over time, they get better. So we didn't use criteria to put kids into, say, well, these kids are no good because they're, you know, below the 5th percentile or, you know, 2 standard deviations worse than the sample mean. We used something called latent class clusters. So because they improve with age, what we wanted to know is whether they improve relative to their peer. So as I say, we used cluster analysis rather than a criterion. So the question then becomes, is the learner always in the same cluster? And the clusters that I'm going to talk about this afternoon, are based on parameters of the dot enumeration measure adjusted for basic reaction time. And it turns out, we were lucky here, I suppose, that at each age there were exactly 3 clusters, which we labeled slow, medium, and fast. And if you do an ordinal correlation between cluster membership, you find that kids tended to stay in the same cluster. Not always. Some kids would go up, some kids would go down, but substantially they stayed in the same cluster. And this is what the clusters look like. This is numbers of dots, this is reaction time, and these are the 3 clusters, and here you've got from 6 years up to 11 years. And one of the things you can see is, of course, the fast group are faster, but also the fast group are already subitizing 4 items at the earliest age, at 6 years, whereas the slow group are already subitizing 2 items. It takes them up to age 8.5 before they're subitizing 4 items. So the point of discontinuity as well as overall reaction time is different. Okay, that's just cluster membership doing this task. Does this bear any relationship to how good they are at arithmetic? So we're now going to use just the clusters that were formed in kindergarten, so when they were 5.5 to 6 in Australia, kindergarten, and we're seeing whether that predicts what they're going to be like at age-appropriate arithmetic. So at 6 years, you can barely see this, sorry about that, this is the slow group, they're getting about 30% right, this is the medium group, they're getting about 60% right, and this is the fast group, they're getting about 80% right on single-digit arithmetic. What about when they're a bit older? So this is two-digit arithmetic at 9.5. Okay, where you've got two-digit addition, two-digit subtraction, and two-digit multiplication. By now you can see the medium group have more or less caught up with the fast group, but the slow group is still way behind on all 3 operations. What about a bit later? Oops, sorry. This is three-digit arithmetic, subtraction, multiplication, and division. There's not much difference between the medium and fast group, but the slow group, and actually this is the smallest group, are still way behind on all 3 operations. So this very simple test of the ability to process numerosities is predictive of how good kids are going to be or how difficult they're going to find learning arithmetic. Now I want to argue that this numerosity processing capacity is not only distinct from general reasoning capacities, but it's also innate. And there are different ways in which you can show this. I'm going to show two sorts of data. Genetic, but first, just to remind you that there are other species that can use numerosity as a discriminative stimulus. First shown in the 30s, 40s by Otto Koehler. This is the raven Yakob, doing a match-to-sample task. So if he matches three blobs on the sample to this tray here, he'll get a reward. If he gets it wrong, doesn't get a reward. And he could do, and other corvids could do this up to about seven. This is a kind of replication of the task I showed you, the blue and green task, in monkeys by Nieder's group in Tübingen. Here they have to match a continuous quantity, which is length. So it's a match to sample task again. And he's recording from individual neurons in the intraparietal sulcus of these monkeys while they're waiting, trying to remember what this looked like so that they could do the match-to-sample task. And he also did one where he used numerosity, so the monkey has to match four dots to four dots. So that should be match. So what he found was that there were neurons in the intraparietal sulcus that responded just in the numerosity task, others that responded only in the length task, and some which responded in both tasks. So again, that points to, in our ancestor from 30 million years ago, or 30 million years ago, there was a common ancestor of macaques and humans. We've inherited a system in the same part of the brain. It's a homologue, not an analogue, for processing numerosities. And just to show you this, this is from the experiment I showed you before, but it's a different slice, different way of slicing the brain, but slicing down like that. And you can see a little blob here in the intraparietal sulcus, right at the fundus of the intraparietal sulcus, here on the left. And this is one of Nieder's monkeys in a really homologous position. Okay. So I'm just going to show off now. Last year I published my first comparative paper where I looked at numerosity processing in another species. Fish. So Christian Agrillo spent some time in my lab, but he's really the fish expert. I'm not the fish expert. But we did this experiment. We wanted to compare fish with Italian students. So this is the task we gave to Italian students. What they had to do is they had to say which of two stimuli had more objects in them. So they would see stimulus one and then stimulus two. And what we wanted to know was, are there two systems in the Italian student brain, one for subitizing and one for comparisons beyond the subitizing range? And what we know is that, or what we found out, was that in the subitizing range, there's no distance effect. That is, it's as easy to say four is bigger than one than four is bigger than three. But for Italian students, if you go beyond the subitizing range, then you get a ratio effect. So it's the bigger the difference between the numbers, the easier it is. And this is the way we did it with fish. We have a transparent tank. We put our subject fish in there. We have a few other conspecifics swimming around in one tank, and other conspecifics swimming around in another tank. And these guppies, they're very small fish, small brains, they like to swim in shoals. And so the question is, would they go, they prefer big shoals to small shoals for reasons I'm happy to explain, and would they go to, would they show a ratio effect for large numbers and no ratio effect for small numbers? So if there were, say, four fish here and one fish there, would they show no ratio effect as compared to four versus three? Okay. So, this is Italian students. Now, it's true, I know this is a comparison, okay, but we didn't put these Italian students into tanks of water. And you might say this invalidates the whole comparison. We thought about it, but it's actually rather difficult to do. That we'd have to have other Italian students swimming on either side of the net. We didn't do it. Anyway, so what we found was that in terms of both accuracy and reaction time, there's no ratio effect. These are the ratios down here, 0.25, 0.33, 0.75. 0.75 is the most difficult condition. No ratio effect for these small numbers, but for the large numbers you get a reduction in accuracy and an increase in reaction time. What about for the fish? No ratio effect for the small quantities, but a significant ratio effect for the large quantities. We didn't measure reaction time for the fish for obvious reasons. However, what we did do is we looked at newborn fish versus more experienced fish. Fish that had been to schools. That sounds terrible, good. Anyway, so there's no difference. So they're born with this capacity. Okay. So now let's have a look at, in humans, what happens if you do have an inherited capacity. This capacity could sometimes go wrong. So in previous research, in twin studies, rather small sample twin, one small sample twin study, you found that there's, if you compare monozygotic twins with dizygotic twins, there's more higher concordance in numerical ability for the monozygotes and the dizygotes. And in a study by my colleague Yulia Kovas and friends, if you do a large-scale study with lots of thousands of seven-year-olds, and you do look at the genetic correlations, you find that something like 30% of the genetic correlation across a range of tests is specific to mathematical abilities. There are also X chromosome disorders, and damage to the X chromosome can lead to parietal lobe abnormalities with numerosity processing particularly affected. So in a study that we did, and so has De Haan's group, in Turner's syndrome, you find Turner's syndrome females are not very good at doing those simple numerosity tasks I showed you, and they're also not very good at arithmetic, even though they've got normal or even high intelligence. But you also find in Fragile X and Klinefelter's or other X chromosome disorders, you find mathematical abilities probably the most effective of the cognitive abilities, but other things are effective as well. Now, I want to tell you briefly about a twin study in progress that we're doing. This is work by a group, myself and a group at my student Mashish Rampura, and a group at the Institute of Child Health, part of UCL. So we've got quite a lot of twins. Each twin has had 40 behavioral tests. They've all had brain scans. What we did is we did a factor analysis of those 40 tests, and we found four factors, which I'm going to focus on one, which I'm going to call number processing. So there's a standardized test called WAND, Vexers of numerical dimensions, and one particular dimension, numerical operations, it's simple arithmetic. Also, we had timed addition, timed subtraction, timed multiplication, and we took something called inverse efficiency, which just puts accuracy and speed together, and dot enumeration. And we calculated for each subject, and the Hallanovis distance is just a multi-dimensional way of plotting where an individual is compared to the sample mean. And because we had they were twins, we could estimate the heritability of these particular factors. And this is just the standard heritability, H2. And so timed addition, timed subtraction, timed multiplication, and dot enumeration are all heritable. So C2 is just shared environment, V2 is unique environment, using standard behavior genetic methods. But you can do something a bit more interesting than that by using kind of bivariate analysis here. So what you do is you look at the correlation between monozygotes and dizygotes. No, put it another way. You look at the correlation between dot enumeration and addition, subtraction, multiplication, and finger sequencing, which is kind of interesting. And whether you've got a higher correlation of dot enumeration in one of those arithmetic measures for monozygotes than dizygotes, let's put it simply. And so what you find is that actually dot enumeration correlates more highly with addition efficiency in monozygotes and dizygotes, and similarly for these other arithmetic tasks, showing that indeed the dot enumeration is heritably important for arithmetic. Now, I said we scanned all these kids from 8 to 14 when we scanned them first. We're hoping to rescan them again soon. Just need the money. So we found reduced gray matter density overall in that area there, which is exactly the same as Elizabeth Isaacs had found in an original study with a different population. And it's exactly the coordinates of one of those two areas that Castelli, Glaser and I found when we were doing our numerosity processing task. But what was interesting was that if you plot how good people are at number tasks, that is, we take them a Hallanobis distance, and we look at the relationship between gray matter density and how good they are at mathematics, we get something really interesting, which has never been observed before, which I really like. The white dots are dyscalculics, but let's leave those aside for a moment. The red dots are the kids who are farthest from the sample mean. Those are the kids who are really bad, and the blue are the ones who are the best at, on factor one. And what you can see is that the kids who are bad start with higher gray matter density in that area, but end up with lower. And the kids who are good start off with lower gray matter density and end up with more. Now, we're not quite sure how to explain this at the moment, and I'm open to suggestions. I mean, of course, we have thought about it, but we're not completely convinced we've got the right answer there. But there are important changes. We can also look at the heritability of this region of interest abnormality, and you get significant region of interest heritability. But if you look at region of interest and the Mahalanobis distance using this cross-twin, cross-trait correlation, you also get a high heritability. Okay, and that's just for all the kids. So some of them are good, some of them are bad. Let's look at the kids who are really bad. These are a group I call dyscalculics. So those of you who haven't seen dyscalculics before, this works. Let me just move it on.
What you do like very, very much. I do like science and history.
So tell me what your favourite thing
you like.
Dinosaurs.
Like dinosaurs?
Yeah, I especially love dinosaurs. There's a pretty, pretty simple sword called Dracorex, and its name means Dragon King. And amazingly, all by its beetles can leap their family tree back to a very small insect-eating lizard. There are no mammals in the age of dinosaurs except...
So I would like you to fill in the number that is missing. So what have we got here?
27.
Plus something equals...
30.
Yes, now 27 plus...
3.
Now the next one.
He just written down 2 as being what you need to add to 8 to make 30. And now his teacher is asking him to build up 8 to 30 using rods and unit cubes, white unit cubes. And you can see he's having trouble doing
now
this. He really doesn't have much confidence or much skill in putting out the right number. So it really takes quite a lot of encouragement and hints from the teacher for him to get this right.
Next.
How many of you
Now, the reason I'm showing you this kid is he's 8 years old, he's obviously articulate, he's obviously quite scholarly, he's interested in dinosaurs, he knows a lot about dinosaurs, he knows more than me about dinosaurs, so he's obviously, you know, can absorb information. But even on these simple tasks, which most kids in his class would be able to do very easily, he's completely hopeless. And this is one of the standard pictures of dyscalculia. You can have very high intelligence, but you can be really, really disastrous on these simple number tasks. And when you test kids like this, they're really bad on the simple number tasks. This is a kind of test that one of our sort of standardized tests. I'll show you. This is, you have to match the dots to a digit.
You have to
press a right hand key if you think they match, a left hand key if you think they don't match.
Excellent. Let's do some more. Remember, how many spots are there? Does this match the number? Can you go faster this time? Press left or right to start.
So we're measuring both accuracy and speed and comparing it to children of his own age, he's 9. Okay, so, I mean, it's hard to get a sense of this, but he's actually very slow at doing this. And he also does something you saw that typically developing kids won't do, which is use their fingers to point to the dots. Now, it's a perfectly sensible strategy if you want to get it right to point to the dots, but typically developing kids don't. Now, there's quite a lot of work now on dyscalculia, and in this excellent volume, I see there's a paper by me on dyscalculia, so I won't go into the existing work. I just want to show you some new stuff we've been doing on dyscalculic brains. So this is for this is from the same study I showed you before, but we picked out the dyscalculics. What I'm going to focus on in this part of the talk are white matter, not grey matter. Okay, and it's a subsample of the sample of twins. And this isn't the twin study really. It's 11 dyscalculics, 11 matter controls. About the same ages, similar gestational age, similar full-scale IQ, similar verbal IQ, but of course a big difference from numerical operations. And this calculation are significantly worse, as you would expect. So I just want to show you, in a different sort of way, what happens over... They're distributed over age from 8 to 14. the differences in white matter volume from 8 to 14. So these are the dyscalculics. Different regions given there on the right. And what you can see is that white matter volume goes down as they get older. I mean, this isn't a longitudinal study, this is a cross-sectional study. But in the matched controls, white matter volume either stays the same or goes up. So they're increasing white matter volume, the matched controls, but the dyscalculics are not. We think, of course, that white matter volume indicates the strength of long-term connections in the brain, so it may reflect rather directly the effects of learning on the brain. And so you can see that if you take that analysis, then the match controls seem to be making more connections or strengthening connections between parts of the brain, whereas the dyscalculics are not. Now notice they're matched for intelligence. It's not a function of intelligence. It's got to do with something else. We think it's got to do with their numerical abilities. So let me just sum up. Sorry, I've been going on for a long time. So just to sum up, what does all this mean? Well, cultural tools, that is counting words and symbols, are important. But were initially used to express concepts that we already possessed. Why would we have a word for five unless we have the concept of fiveness? There's a whole other talk I could give you about the archaeology of numbers, which I'm very happy to do. We share a capacity to process numerosities with a wide range of species, suggesting it's inherited. And this, by the way, might help to explain examples of horizontal décalage, such as differences in conservation of number and continuous quantity. So continuous quantity doesn't depend upon the same inherited characteristics as number. So you might not expect them to develop at the same rate. There may be individual differences in this inherited capacity, as I've tried to show. And of course this does happen in humans, and it's called dyscalculia. So that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for this nice talk. We have time for some questions. So yes, about 15 minutes.
Oh, that one, yes.
Yes, sorry for my English, but I'm going to slowly. Because I've read in the newspaper, there are often papers about articles about foreign in schools, because there is a correlation between the success of experience of primary school and the background of the parents.
Yes.
And in this paper, you say that the school often is not able to see the progress of this population in children. It's not easy for the school to remember there is a problem. Do you understand what I mean?
Yes, so the background of the parents is important.
So the background is important. So my question is, do you think that from the neurological point of view, if the school could solve that kind of problem? Because I think that sometimes there should be a personalized help. Because you also told me about the personalized, for example, solver.
Yeah.
At school, in schools, in general, one teacher talks to 20, 30 children. So I don't know, do you think that one day school could find a solution?
Well, thank you. Thank you for that. The question is, you know, can we find some way of identifying kids very early who have this problem and design a curriculum that's appropriate for them, individualized learning pathways. As it happens, we've got a paper coming out in next week in which we say exactly this. Thank you very much for raising this point. If we could, I mean, the other thing that we found with dyscalculics and kids with low numeracy in general was, and this is really what's prompted the research, when we started doing this research, we found that these kids who are dyscalculic are really, really, really unhappy at school. I mean, it makes them distressed to be unable to do what all the other kids in the class can do. And the other kids, so their self-esteem goes down, and they, you know, every day there's a maths lesson, and every day they have to show how stupid they are. And other kids get annoyed with them because they're disruptive in class. Now, if we could identify these children before they get to school, or at the beginning of their school life, say, we know these kids are going to have problems, let's make sure that they don't have to do the same thing as all the other kids do in math, they have to do something different, then I think it would relieve the kids of unhappiness, it would help them learn better, it would stop them disrupting classes for kids of average or high ability, and it would make their teachers happier. Because the other thing we did was we interviewed the teachers, and the teachers all felt guilty that they were unable to help these kids. And they were unable to help them because they had no special training in what to do with dyscalculics. So you're absolutely right. If we could have individualized learning pathways for kids with these problems, everybody would benefit. And one of the points I make in that article, and also the one that's coming out next week, is that if one way in which you can do this is you can have you can use learning technologies, so adaptive computer games that will go at the rate that the child needs. So it wouldn't be like in class where the teacher's going at the rate of the average student. Here, the game would be going at the rate that the child needs. And in that paper, I point to a website where we've developed some games that kids with dyscalculia can use. So thank you for raising that point. Yeah.
Do we know whether, if taught correctly, these dyscalculic children can improve and get like normal match abilities?
No, we don't know that. I mean, we are running a study of what we call high-functioning adult dyscalculics. So people who are very good at their jobs, but who are dyscalculic. Now, they're intelligent, they're hard-working, they've often been very well educated, but they're still dyscalculic on tests like the ones I showed you. Now, of course, they didn't have special help. And so we don't know what would have happened if they had had special help. Would they still be dyscalculic? Now, we just don't know what would happen. My guess is that they could be competent but not normal. So a bit like you can get dyslexic children to be competent readers, or even good readers, but they won't be reading in the way that typically developing kids read. They'll be reading in a different way. And the different way will depend upon what their actual deficit is. So kids who've got, for example, a phonological deficit will tend to resort more to whole word reading, whole word recognition reading, than kids who are able to analyze the phonological structure of the language. So they'll be reading differently from normal kids. So I suspect it's going to be the same for dyscalculics, but I don't know. I mean, what I would say is, give me £10 million and 10 years, invite me back in 2023 and I will give you the answer. But we don't know. I mean, and it's very difficult, I mean, in England anyway, it's very difficult to get the government to recognise dyscalculia and to do something about it. So we don't know.
And is
it
generally linked with dyslexia?
The answer is yes, it is, but we don't know why. So the prevalence for dyslexia is say 7%, and for dyscalculia is say 5%. So you should have 7% of 5% who have both conditions if they were independent. In fact, you have so less than 1%. So in fact, you get something between 20% and 40% who have both conditions, depending on your criterion. So very highly significant comorbidity, but we don't know why. If you look at the brains of dyslexia, where the brains are abnormal in dyslexia, then not where the brains are abnormal in dyscalculia. So they're somewhere else. They're in the temporal lobe typically. If you look at the genes that are involved, well, we don't really know what the genes for dyscalculia are, but they're likely to be in the X chromosome. But almost all the candidate genes for dyslexia are somewhere else. I mean, there are a lot of candidate genes for dyslexia, but there are none of them in the X chromosome as far as I know. So we don't know why you have this comorbidity, but you do. So it's not, and if you look at dyscalculic, we've done this, and one of my colleagues, Karen Landell, has done a much bigger and better study than the one that we did together. If you look at children in first and second grade on our sorts of dyscalculia tests and on standard tests for dyslexia, like phonological tests for dyslexia, and you look at the kids who have both problems, they're no different from the kids who have each problem. So the kids with a double deficit are just the same on the phonological tests as the single deficit dyslexics. And the kids who have both problems, the double deficit kids, are just the same as the single deficit dyscalculics on the dyscalculia tests. So it's not as though these two conditions are interactive. So if you're dyslexic, it doesn't make you worse on the dyscalculia test. So it's a mystery why you should have kids who have both of these problems. Maybe we'll find out one day. Yeah.
Is there any relation to where these kids, what kind of school they come to, what kind of family origin, what's the background, have any issues?
Of course, in general it does. I mean, in general, mathematic attainment depends on your family background. But it's not clear why, and at least to me it's not clear why. So, for example, if you come from a very poor background, or let's say a very non-numerate background, so there's not much number talk in the household. We've just done some research on this. Not much number talk in the household means that the kids are not as good on number tasks as kids where there's a lot of number talk in the household. But why isn't there number talk in the household? Could it be that the parents themselves have some kind of inherited disability with numbers which they passed on to their kids? Or is it nothing to do with that? So I think there's a lot we don't know about why kids who come from numerically deprived backgrounds are not very good at number tasks. It may be because they've inherited bad genes. It may be because you actually need quite a lot of stimulation early on in order to be up to typical levels in school. And of course, the thing is, you might be terrible when you arrive at school, but you get appropriate teaching, you might you might catch on. So I'm sorry, I can't answer that question very well. Like most of the questions I've been posed today, I haven't got very good answers. Yes.
Maybe a last question.
What should we do with this confusion about the question?
No. Okay. Now, my question is just very interesting, all your talking program. Interesting, you know, what it is. What about this example you're using about this high functional, discalculic patient? I was just wondering if they had any problem with the space representation. That's my big question.
Spatial?
Spatial, yeah.
What aspect of space?
A representation of space. they have any problem with using the reference system? Like when you use right and left, how do they use the reference system? Because
well, space is many different, yes, has many different aspects.
Of the distance?
Well, we've got one study in which we looked at the ability to discriminate lengths in dyscalculics and time, as we also looked at time. And what we found in this particular study, so you just see one length and another length, you have to say which is longer. And what we found was, well, we found two things. One is that there's no correlation between this ability and your arithmetic ability. And secondly, that your ability in doing this length task, or indeed the time task, correlates with one brain structure, but your ability to do the arithmetic correlates with another brain structure. But this is just, you know, one aspect of space. Of course, there is a condition known as Gerstmann syndrome, where individuals are bad at calculation and dyscalculic. They also have problems with left-right discrimination, and also usually dyspraxic as well, so they have problems coordinating movement in space. But I think those are going to be a very tiny minority of the kids who've got dyscalculia. So the answer is, when you look at the standard test of spatial ability, different types of spatial ability, there doesn't seem to be any relationship. But that doesn't mean there isn't, it just means that we haven't found the spatial test that actually correlates with the...
My question is related to this example as well. You gave about Turner syndrome, because I studied children today, usually have this confusion, but they also have a brain problem with the spatial representation.
Yes.
No, and also they have a problem with the white matter. They have a white matter as connectivity. So yeah. I'm trying to make a little bit of a problem.
Okay. Well, I'm not an expert on Turner syndrome, and we looked at two different carrier types, those with maternal X and those with paternal X. We didn't look at those who had mosaicism. Okay, so we just looked at these simple cases, and it may be different for them. Then we did look at one ring. Anyway, we take your point that they often do have spatial problems, and we didn't find that on formal tests. And I also had an informal test, which was I asked all of the subjects, didn't have many subjects, only about 12 or 13. I said, "Do you play a sport?" Which seemed to be like a good way of assessing their spatial abilities. And so one female who had paternal X, they're meant to be worse, I don't know if it's true, meant to be worse on spatial tasks than those with maternal X. I said, "Do you play a sport?" And she said, "Yes." I said, "What do you do?" And she said, "Well, I do trampolining." And I thought, well, that's pretty impressive for somebody who's got poor spatial skills. And I said, "Well," I have a follow-up question. I said, "Are you any good?" And she said, "Well, I didn't get into the England team." So I said, "But you do it represent?" Oh, he said, "I represent my county and my university at trampoline." So now that's just one case. Okay. So I don't. So the answer is I don't really know. And we were only looking at high functioning terms, so they all had normal or superior IQs. So it may be different. I mean, there are, you know, different types of Turners, and you almost certainly know more about this than I do.
Any more questions?
If I may?
Yes, okay.
Today in your talk, that was very fascinating, you emphasised the role of gut counting.
Yeah.
Would you say that it could be a good screening test for dyscalculia, or do you think then even more earlier differences on just, you know, like the baby usual, you know, comparison between two dots and three dots, and in which we can find already some differences that may then predict dyscalculia, difficulty in mathematics?
Well, I think that, I mean, it's been found that your counting ability is quite a good predictor. Mm-hmm. But the question is, why is your counting ability better than somebody else's? And so I think that depends upon your ability to represent numerosities. And that's why you're good at counting. And it's going to be difficult to untangle those two things. And it may be that having a counting, I mean, a lot of people use counting tests and predict arithmetic on the basis of this. Maybe that's easier than doing what we do. Then it will correlate highly with it. We haven't done a comparison of whether counting ability is how that's related to. We haven't done it directly, but we do have some quite interesting data, which is a new thing that Piaget talked about, which is use of fingers. So we had, I'll ask you a question, here's a test for you, all right? Okay, at 5 years old, right, between 5 and 6, there were kids who used their fingers to do single-digit addition, and there were kids who don't. Which are better, the kids who use their fingers or the kids who don't?
Better to give the highest accuracy on solving the operation?
This is, yeah, on accuracy, yeah. Yeah.
Huh?
Finger use. Okay, so I'll ask everybody this question. Okay, so there are kids at 5 doing single digit addition, 5 to 6. About half of them use their fingers, half of them don't. Who thinks that the finger users are more accurate than the non-finger users? Hands up. Few. Who thinks that the non-finger users are more accurate than the finger users?
It's their choice to use either.
Yes, it's their choice. Of course it's their choice.
No, it's a result.
Are they succeeding
or not?
Yeah, this is a great question. Okay. It's actually a trick question. Because what you find is that there are about half of the non-finger users are better than the finger users. And the other half of the non-finger users are worse than the finger users. So there's some kids who no longer need to use their fingers, and some kids who haven't figured out that they can use their fingers. And what we've been doing recently is we've been trying to model the relationship between finger use and the strategy that the children use for a single-digit addition. Are they using a counting strategy? Are they using a retrieval strategy? Are they using guessing, right? And it turns out to be quite complicated. I'm happy to talk about this, but I have the data here. But and of course, finger use is related to counting. What I can tell you from our data, our longitudinal data, is that between the ages of, say, 5.5 and 7, the kids who are still using their fingers at 7 are not doing very well. So some kids who are using their fingers at 5 stop using their fingers, and they're sort of all right. And there's some kids who are, most of the kids who aren't using their, so the good kids who are not using their fingers continue not to use their fingers. The kids who are not good, who are not using their fingers, tend to start using their fingers and continue to use their fingers up to the age of 7. which is when we stopped recording this data. They're still not very good, and they're still using rather primitive strategies. So they're using their fingers to help them count on, basically. Okay.
So thank you again for this. Et je vous donne rendez-vous la semaine prochaine où nous entendrons notre collègue Catherine Pernoud et la résolution des opérations. Moi,
Yeah, I would make reservations here.